Greetings, listeners and friends of RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast for April 2019. I am Bruce Bathols, VK3UV, your presenter for this month. Our broadcast is transmitted live to air on the first Monday of each month, except for January, on a range of frequencies which can all be found on our website www.raotc.org.au. And we again thank all of our volunteers who relay this program at the various times. Please note that we also have an evening transmission on 80 metres at 20:30 hours in Melbourne, and in Tasmania and via a telecast. At our last committee meeting in March, it was decided to have our broadcast file uploaded to our website on the day prior to the live-to-air broadcast, thus giving our listeners earlier access in these times of poor HF conditions. Our website is www.raotc.org.au. Club News. The following item is mainly for our Victorian listeners. In our March broadcast, we advised of the passing of Peter Drury, VK3JN. Now, Peter's wife, Marge, has asked us to publicise a garage sale which will be held over the weekend, the 27th and 28th of April, to dispose of Peter's amateur radio equipment. The sale will take place at the Newstead Community Centre, Pyrenees Highway in Newstead in central Victoria. Further details may be obtained from Marge Drury on 0423 209 119. That number again, 0423 209 119. And interstate listeners are also most welcome to attend. Now here is the rest of our club news. We welcome three new members. John Dawes, VK5BJE and VK5PF. Previous call signs VK3YFG and VK3BJE became new RAOTC full member number 1764 on the 9th of March 2019. And David Learmouth, VK3QM, previous call sign VK3XLD, became new RAOTC full life member number 1765 on the 20th of March 2019. And Don Bainbridge, VK3IT and VK3BIG, previous call signs VK3BDJ and VK3YCV, became RAOTC full member number 1766 on the 22nd of March 2019. And a most hearty welcome to the ranks of RAOTC to John, David and Don. Now it's my sad duty to report the passing of two of our members. We have been belatedly advised that John Bennett, VK3ZA, previous call sign VK2SIG, RAOTC life member number 939, became a silent key in August 2018. And also we've been advised that Peter Walton, VK6QK, RAOTC member number 1627, became a silent key on the 29th of September 2018. We pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleagues. Thank you. Here is an article entitled The Big Discone, written by and forwarded to us by RAOTC member Ken Morgan VK3 CEK. History tells us that Mr. Armig Kandawang, a New Yorker of Russian origin, laid claim to the invention of the discone antenna when, on May 15, 1943, he applied for a patent for what he called a broadband antenna. The patent was finally granted on February 6, 1945. His inventive effort was sparked by the requirement for an aircraft radio communication antenna, small, rigid, and offering minimum wind resistance. At that time, the frequency of interest was in the UHF range. A diagram from Kandawang's patent application probably best shows his idea and how well it adapted to a blister shape of the aircraft skin. For this invention and other meritorious work, he was awarded the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the IEEE Award in International Communications, for pioneering contributions to international communications, television broadcasting, and air navigation. The award was made in 1980 by the prestigious IEEE. My interest in radio communication peaked during the Cold War. A Yaesu FRG-7, a long wire trapped dipole antenna, homemade demodulator, CRO and a VIC-20, with a particular plug-in cartridge plus all cables, enabled the decoding of RTTY and CW transmitted on HF frequencies. RTTY signals abounded: press, weather, naval, aeronautical, embassy, etc. Once a transmission was selected, the problem was to find the right combination of variables to resolve the signal. These variables were upper or lower sideband, transmission speed, the baud, the signal shift or mode, great rejoicing when an understandable message appeared on the screen. But enough of this reminiscing. Back to the discone. Around Christmas of 1984-85, family finances enabled the purchase of a second-hand AOR AR2002 scanner. A good unit even today, providing frequency coverage from 25 to 550 and 800 to 1300 MHz. Modes were AM, wide and narrow FM, with good sensitivity and all of 20 memories. This would enable some exploration of the frequencies above 30 MHz. After experimenting with the set, using the small telescopic antenna supplied, it became obvious that the external wideband antenna was necessary. Selection of a suitable unit took a little time. There was no internet, and I was not a radio club member in those days. Being an avid reader of Electronics Australia and AEM, I soon found that the discone was the antenna of choice. In the July issue of AEM, there was an advertisement placed by Ash Point Industries Proprietary Limited of Alexandra, New South Wales. It said, "Build a wideband antenna with our hub, comprising a disc and cone piece, castings plus insulator, $41. I was quick to put a cheque in the mail. In the same magazine, commencing on page 112, Roger Harrison, VK2ZTB, had an article entitled "The Scantenna." The article spoke of Armig Kandawang and gave brief descriptions of the discone characteristics, design and construction methods. When the castings and insulator arrived, I purchased 12 2-metre lengths of 1 centimetre outside diameter aluminium tubes and a quantity of suitable stainless steel nuts, bolts and washers from the hardware store. Construction of the antenna was a labour of love. With 8 2-metre lengths of tube to form a skeletal cone and 8 0.625 metre lengths of tube to form the skeletal disc, I calculated that with these lengths, the dimensions of the disc and cone castings, and given a cone angle of 60 degrees, I would have a disc cone with a low frequency cutoff of some 40 MHz. A great place to mount the antenna would be the on east side upper wall. At that period, my home was a two-story, brick lower, weatherboard upper. A great place to mount the antenna would be on the east side upper wall. A friend donated a paper tiger aluminium mast, 6.78 metres long. With careful placement and measurements, the mast could be supported on brackets, with the antenna located 3 metres above the roof edge, the maximum allowed by the council. With the disc cone attached to the mast, the two were an awkward package to handle, let alone lift and fit onto brackets that had been fastened through weatherboards and onto the studs. This problem remained unresolved until two plumbers working on a sewage problem at our home and saw the fearsome-looking mast, disc cone package and asked about it. On learning about it and the mounting problem, one said that he could fix it. A ladder enabled him to reach a lower part of the roof. We passed the mast stroke disc end to him with a length of 213 coax. Holding it like a javelin, he literally walked up the steel-tiled roof of the ridge. There he held it vertically and gradually lowered it down the side of the house until it sat in the lower bracket, high up on the extension ladder. I bolted up the brackets as fast as possible, passed through the coax, through a prepared entry hole and bolted on to the earth wire. It was up, celebrations, and the plumber was rewarded. At this point, we just take a short break to comply with ACMA rules and make our announcement. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now back to Ken's interesting article, the disc cone. The aluminium mast and disc cone glistened in the sun, a thing of beauty. That night the wind blew, the skeletal tubes vibrated, the mast vibrated, and the wall resonated. No sleep for the children, the XYL, Brenda, and I. Complaints were strong. The house will fall down. What was Dad doing? The brain went into overdrive seeking solutions. The ends of all tubes had been blocked with silicon. Neoprene rubber had been placed between the steel brackets and the aluminium mast. What had I missed? Suspicion soon fell on the 2-metre-long elements, sprouting proudly and from the aluminium cone. Their freedom to vibrate had to be deadened. Another visit to the hardware shop resulted in more silicon and about 3 metres of clear plastic flexible tubing. The plastic tubing was cut into 8 pieces, each 300 millimetres long. Then number one son climbed the extension ladder and loosened the bracket bolts. Sitting astride the roof ridge, I filled a piece of tube with silicon and slipped it about 50 mil over the aluminium tube. It fitted nicely, and the tubing still retained the curve it had when purchased as a coil. All elements were so treated, the mast being turned to bring each element into my reach. When finished, the antenna looked quite futuristic. That night all was silent. We slept and the antenna could remain. How did it perform? The combination of big disc cone and the scanning characteristic of the AR2002 made a powerful tool to explore what now includes VHF and UHF. Unfortunately, I had little to compare it with and did not keep much in the way of records. Certainly, I could not transmit. However, I picked up the tick-tock signals of the polar orbiting satellites. The first, TIOS-1, was put into orbit in 1960. There seemed a certain regularity to these signals, but I could not identify them. I recorded one transmission and may still have the tape. I even constructed a signal-operated cassette recorder controller to try and automatically record the signals. This resulted in some disaster. I tried to pick off the squelch signal from a computer plug connection at the back of the scanner and succeeded in upsetting the processor, which controlled the AR2002. It had to go to hospital at Emtronics and came back no charge, beyond cartage. Probably the processor had to be reset. Turn on power with buttons A and B depressed. It was years later that the signals were finally identified, and these simple-sounding transmissions changed the whole of my radio life. In 1997, I erected an ICOM AH7000, similar to a diamond disc cone, some 3 metres above the roof ridge of my home. It seems to transmit quite adequately. Theory says it offers an impedance of 50 ohms. No transmitter here has complained of high SWR at either VHF or UHF. It receives the satellite signals but does exhibit a deafness when the satellite is near overhead. And the references to some of this information came from the AEM in July of 1985, the IEEE USA, and the ARRL Antenna Handbook of the 16th edition. Thanks, Ken, VK3CEK, for that interesting story. Here are two articles on the International Space Station. Thanks to John, VK3XM, for bringing them to our attention. Both articles were published in the ARRL QST magazine. New amateur radio packet gear awaits unpacking. New amateur radio on the International Space Station, ARIS, packet equipment waits unpacking and installation on board the station after arriving in November as part of the cargo transported via a Russian 71P Progress resupply vehicle. The new packet module for NA1SS will replace the current packet gear, which has been intermittent over the past year. With the arrival of Progress complete, the crew has to find time to unpack Progress, uninstall the intermittent module, and then set up and test the replacement packet module. The ISS packet system was reported to have gone down in July 2017, although it unexpectedly came back to life the following summer. At the time of the failure, NASA ISS Ham Radio Project engineer Kenneth Ransom, N5VHO, said the revived system would fill the gap until the replacement module arrived. The packet system operates on 145.825 MHz. ARIS hardware team members on the ground were able to locate a functional duplicate of the ISS packet module that had been in use on the ISS for 17 years. In an email to ARIS and other groups CASA supports, Barstow pointed out that ARIS is an official backup system for astronauts to talk with mission control in the unlikely failure of the station's primary communication systems. He said that in 2017, HAMS relayed nearly 89,000 packet messages via the ISS, an average of 243 every day. The statistic so intrigued and amazed Barstow that he decided to get his amateur radio license and gear to join in the activity. Satellite stalwart and ARIS supporter Rick Stoddard, WD9EWK, won the December 2018 QST Cover Plaque Award for his article, Making Digital Contacts Through the ISS. Now, an update to that article is that we now have two new HAM ISS crew launched to the ISS, and is the first since the aborted October flight. Three astronauts, including two radio amateurs, have docked at the International Space Station on the first crewed Soyuz vehicle launch since a dramatic failure in October. The astronauts from the US, Canada and Russia left Kazakhstan at 11:30 UTC on December the 3rd, and the Russian space agency Roscosmos confirmed their successful docking at the station. On board were David St. Jacques KG5 FYI, a Canadian engineer, astrophysicist and medical doctor, space veteran Oleg Komonenko RN3 DX of Russia, and Anne McLean of the US. Investigators have blamed a faulty sensor, said to have been damaged during assembly in Kazakhstan. Crew commander Kononenko said his crew recognized the risks of spaceflight as part of their profession and expressed confidence in flight preparation. The three-person crew's mission was originally set for later this month, but officials moved up the date to avoid leaving the space station unstaffed. When the current ISS crew of cosmonaut Sergei Poropkov and astronaut Serena Ornan-Chancellor, KG5-TMT, and Alexander Gerst, KF5-ONO, returned to Earth on December the 20th. Meanwhile, NASA astronaut Nick Hayde, KG5-TMV, who was on the aborted October 11 Soyuz launch, is getting ready for another try. Hague, NASA astronaut Christina Hammock-Kosh, and cosmonaut Alexei Ovchinin are scheduled to launch from Baikonur Cosmodrome on February the 28th aboard the Russian Soyuz MS-12 spacecraft. The trio will join the ISS Expedition 58 crew that just went up, and they will return to Earth in October 2019 as members of Expedition 60. Hague and Kosh will serve as flight engineers for Expeditions 59 and 60. Ovchinin will serve as flight engineer on Expedition 59 and as commander of Expedition 60. This will be Kosh's first spaceflight. Hague and Ovchinin were on their way to join the station's Expedition 57 crew on October the 11th, when their Soyuz's rocket booster experienced a malfunction shortly after launch, aborting the mission. Both returned safely to Earth. The MS-10 flight abort marked the first Russian human spaceflight booster accident in 35 years. Investigators looking into the October 11 incident said afterward that other Soyuz vehicles may have been similarly defective, but pointed out that additional pre-flight checks had been introduced. NASA offered its own reassurances about continued cooperation with and confidence in the Russian space program. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now here is a short article which will appeal to some of our older members. Morse code. If you think operating in Morse code is something that belongs to the past century, think again. Morse operation remains a popular mainstay of amateur radio, and it continues to attract new interest. Morse code lies at the very origins of amateur radio. Originally, amateur radio communications occurred exclusively in Morse. After 1920, voice-capable radio transmitters became commonly available, but Morse code has carried on as a popular area of amateur radio. Until 2003, the International Telecommunication Union, ITU, required assessment of Morse code proficiency as part of the Global Amateur Radio License Procedure. However, since the World Radio Communication Conference of 2003, that is WRC03, Morse code has become an optional element in amateur radio practice, and many countries have now removed the compulsory Morse component from their amateur radio license requirements. Morse is still used outside of amateur radio. In aviation, for example, the identification letters of navigation beacons are sent in Morse. Morse can be very useful for emergency communications, as an intelligible message can be sent under operating conditions that would make a voice call impossible, and the simple technology involved means equipment can be improvised if necessary. Now here is this month's joke. An elderly man, thinking his wife was losing her hearing, went about 20 feet behind her and asked, "Can you hear me, sweetheart?" No reply. He moved to about 10 feet and inquired again. Again, no reply. And he got to about 5 feet and not a word. A few inches behind her ear, he asked, "Can you hear me now, honey?" His wife said, "For the fourth time, yes." This now concludes our broadcast for April 2019. We hope that you found something interesting. Our next broadcast will be on Monday, the 6th of May. And let me remind you that if you come across an article which you consider might be suitable for inclusion in our broadcasts, please copy it and send it to raotc at raotc.org.au. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Listening now for any check-ins and callbacks. Thank you.